What is permitted on the Sabbath? Who cares? I mean, is that not a retro and archaic question? I mean, when was the last time you thought about what was permitted on the Sabbath? Probably the last time we talked about it here. Or maybe the last time that you thought, you know, it would sure be nice, now that we're all home today, to be able to go and shop for a car together. One of the few remaining things you can't do on a Sunday. So if we don't really think too much about what's permitted on the Sabbath, what's the value of this reading today beyond historical interest? Is there anything? Should we just sit down and sing more songs? I think there are three things. I'm going to put these out to you, and then you can tell me afterward if you thought it was worthwhile. First of all, this story gives us a good framework for understanding the worldviews of both Jesus and the Pharisees. Second, it gives us the occasion to reflect on two very, very big theological words, law and gospel. And they're not only the title of the series that we're in right now, but they're central teaching elements within the Lutheran Christian theological framework. And third, if we've done both of those reasonably well, I believe you might begin to see the Sabbath as a bigger gift than you realized. So let's get rolling. First of all, Jesus and the Pharisees. Tammy was right. I can't think of too many encounters between Jesus and the Pharisees that don't end up conflicted. And so it's natural for us to say, well, Jesus is the ultimate good guy, so therefore the Pharisees must be the bad guys. And it's really better for us to think of them not as bad guys, but as good guys who just don't really get or understand or are open to a better guy. In fact, you would like to have Pharisees for your neighbors, because when you went away on vacation, you know that they'd watch your house for you and bring in the mail and walk the dog if that's necessary. Best way to think about Pharisees is as a reform movement within Judaism. They didn't have any official status as such, although there were officials who were also Pharisees. It was a lay movement, really. And it was timely, and it gained traction during this time because the mediating structures between God and his people were breaking down. There was a king, Herod, who was not in the line of David. He wasn't really seen as a legitimate king. And the temple had already been destroyed once, and it had been rebuilt, but it was seen as largely corrupt. And so these two primary mediating structures between God and his people no longer were holding. And so the third mediating structure, God's word, took on even more significance. And in particular, the first five books of the Bible, also known as the Torah, the law. So the Pharisees believed that the people were still suffering and still struggling because they'd been unfaithful to God's law. And that if they could really amp up and be faithful to it, then God would respond and intervene and would deliver them from captivity, or not captivity, from occupation by the Romans. So that was it. They believed that the law was capable of delivering God's people. Jesus also, interestingly, had no official status. Although we know, because a few weeks ago we observed the baptism of our Lord, and the Father spoke to the Son and claimed him. So Jesus' self-understanding was that he was the Son of God. And Jesus' self-understanding was also that these mediating structures of king and temple and Torah were either going to be fulfilled in him or superseded by him. The deliverance of the people of God was ultimately going to be accomplished through Jesus himself. With me so far? All right, so I'm about to move into a sequence that is a little teachy, and so I hope you had your coffee. But hang in there, because we don't really get to talk too much directly about Lutheran theology here. It underpins everything that we do, but we're not always really clear about what and where and how. So I'm talking about these two words, law and gospel. They're the title to the series that we're in right now, and of course we chose that because it was close to the title Law and Order, and we're loosely structuring our videos and study guide on that. And so the definitions that we offered in that series for law and gospel are good, but they're necessarily short because it had to sound like the intro to Law and Order. Tracking with me? For bonus points, tell me afterward who you think did the voiceover for Law and Gospel. But we say the law is what God expects of us, and the gospel is what God does for us. So if you didn't get enough coffee and you zone out from here on, remember those things. But I'm going to unpack them a little bit because they're true, but they don't really say enough. So we say the law is what God expects of us. The law demands. The law is conditional. It's if then. If you do this, then that will happen. And if then can be both positively directed or negatively directed, right? So we can say to our kids, if you eat your meat and potatoes or your quinoa and kale, you can have dessert. That'd be a positively directed, you know, use of the law. Or you could also say, if you don't finish your dinner, you're cleaning the dishes. Be a negative consequence. All right. The law bends us toward a particular intention. It's by nature coercive. And I'm sure when I said that word, some of you flinched a little bit because we hear coercion as a bad thing always. But it's not. I can tell you, I like that the law is coercive when it's late in the afternoon and I'm sitting in my office and I see the traffic all backed up on Lake Cook Road, and invariably someone has a really important place to go, and so they go whipping through our lot to save the 20 seconds or whatever that it's going to be, but they're doing that at exactly the time that our kids are getting let out from the day school. Parents are picking them up. Not a good combination. And I love the coercive presence of one of Barrington's finest when they're sitting there and observing this. So, you know, it can be a good thing. The law is useful. It's useful. Lutheran theology talks about at least two uses of the law, sometimes three, and I'm going to touch on the third later. But the first use of the law is as a civil authority. It orders our life together. Can you imagine? I'm going to stick with cars for now. Can you imagine if we just left it to people to decide, you know, I believe in the inherent goodwill of people, and so we're not going to set any speed limits or traffic laws. You just kind of do what you want when you want. I mean, can you imagine? We think that's free, but it's chaos. So that's one. That's the first use of the law. Second use of the law has more of a theological element to it, and we talk about it being convicts our conscience. So the law touches within us a sense of what ought to be and our distance from our ability to meet what ought to be. Does that make sense? So we're aware of the distance between how we live and how we ought to live. And when we also have gospel in our lives, which I'm going to talk about in a moment, it's one way. But if we don't have that in our lives, if all we have is this sense of the unbreachable gap between where we are and where we ought to be, we despair. And in fact, that's where Martin Luther was spiritually before the Reformation. He struggled with, how am I a faithful, and, you know, I'm really trying to get it right, but I'm honest too, and I realize how far I am from it, and where's my hope? So he found his hope finally in the gospel, which is different from the law. The gospel is unconditional promise. Those two words are really important together. Unconditional promise. Not if then, but simply because. Because. And when we talk about the content of the gospel, when we talk about the content of the gospel, it is always at least this. That the world is restored, given life, made right, through the life and death and resurrection and ascension of Jesus Christ, who opens up possibilities to us that would otherwise never exist, and who's Lord of all. Right? So when we talk about the gospel is what God does for us, it's in particular in and through the work of the person of Jesus. Now, sometimes when we talk about gospel content, we focus on what we say about Jesus. What we say about Jesus. And that focus tends to be around forgiveness. Forgiveness of sin. Fresh start. And a lot of big words here. We're going to define sin as anything that separates us from God and from each other. So there's this separation, there's this distance, there's this gap, however you want to think about it. How is it closed? Sometimes we use monetary terms. Jesus himself taught this way. He talked about a debt that was just insurmountable in a story that he was telling. Could never possibly pay it back. Now we understand money and debt, and you know there's good debt and not so good debt. Maybe some of you think there's no good debt. I'm not going to argue, but not good debt is when we can't possibly pay it back. Can't possibly. No matter how hard we work the rest of our lives, the hole that we've dug is greater than we could ever possibly repay. Now, what would it be like if someone came to you on any given day and said, this hole that you've dug that you can never pay back, I am filling in. It is as though it never happened. You've got a fresh start, clean slate, go. And can you just feel the lightening in that? By the way, I don't have the power to do that. But spiritually, I do. Every Sunday, in multiple ways, you hear here that God has done precisely that with what separates us from God and others. We call that forgiveness of sin. And it's not something that we can do for ourselves. If I wrong you, I don't really get to say, you know, that wasn't such a big deal, so it's okay. Only you can forgive that. And finally, only God can. So the gospel focuses often on forgiveness. But when we also look beyond that at what Jesus himself teaches, we find that it includes forgiveness, but it's not limited to that. It includes things like healing and feeding, things that happened in these encounters today. It includes restoration, forming into community, love in many expressions. The gospel frees and makes possible. The law bends and coerces. The gospel frees and makes possible. Now, you might say, well, then law bad, gospel good. But I hope you hear that in the absence of the law, the gospel is really just kind of a blank check. And if we can't agree on what the law is, then we each make our own, which is kind of worse than what we have. So they need each other. But this is important. The law tells us how to live. But the gospel gives us life. I mean, This is a little crude, but the law doesn't matter to people who are no longer living. It doesn't. Now, some of you are thinking, yeah, but there's state laws and all that kind of stuff. You know what I'm saying. Once you're no longer living, the speed limits don't apply to you. But the gospel gives life. Even more than that, it raises from the dead. So, is that enough? Got it? With me still? Take a breath. Moving into more application. All right, so this framework is really helpful for us to see what was going on between Jesus and the Pharisees. Because the Pharisees are looking at the world and these encounters with Jesus through the lens of the law. What is permitted? And they see Jesus, he and his disciples picking grain. That's clearly forbidden. And they see Jesus healing this man. And you can quibble and say, well, he didn't actually touch him, so was the work really done? Trust me, if they're enraged, they get it. He's doing what's not permitted on the Sabbath. The very thing that we think is going to help us be delivered by God, he's just thumbing his nose at it. Jesus looks at that whole thing through another lens, and that's the lens of the gospel. What gives life? Right now, I don't care what day it is, what gives life? And the disciples were hungry. They weren't just looking for a snack. They were itinerant. They were moving from place to place. The community wasn't really established. A lot of times they didn't have a place to stay. They needed to eat. How about the man with the withered hand? He was not on disability. They didn't have such a thing. So here's someone who lacks the capacity to work and provide for his family. And in all likelihood, because he was seen as flawed, he also would have been in some ways restricted from life in the community. So it's a big deal. And Jesus heals him. He gives him a life. He gives him a fresh start, new possibilities. Whose Sabbath is it? And Jesus says, Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. It's mine. Well, let me ask you, is the Son of Man Lord of your Sabbath? That was a little sneaky question, because kind of like a second use of the law. And we've already established the answer to that is probably not. Probably not. Well, why might we want him to be? Why might we want him to be? Someone is going to be Lord of your Sabbath. Someone or something, or some combination of someones and some things. And there is no one who is going to give more than he receives than Jesus. And if you remember back in the fall, we talked about idols. And idols being not bad things, but good things that we make too much of. And the nature of idols is that the sacrifice they demand is greater than the good that they deliver. And, it's not like images of God, but idols for us are really good things. Our work, our families, our homes, the general idea of success, health, these are good things. But if they are the best thing in our lives, they're going to crush us. They're going to crush us. I mean, in this town, I've lived here long enough to, I think, say this. We run the risk of idolizing our kids. And they can't bear the weight of that. They can't bear the weight of that. They're not made to. I'm indebted to Tim Keller and Augustine a little bit for some of these thoughts. Augustine writes in the Confessions that there's an ordering to the, there's a right ordering of the loves in our lives. And he never suggests that there ought be nothing besides God who we love, but only that the other loves be subordinate to our love for God. And when we get that ordering wrong, and get things out of order, we end up frustrated, despairing, even crushed. Now, when I talk to people about Sabbath, more often than not, the first place they go is, you know, I'm so busy. Okay, I'm not going to do a whole lot about logistics, but the busier we are, the more we need Sabbath. I mean, we're not made to run round the clock. We have the ability to run round the clock. I mean, you can, whatever your endeavor is, you can go around the clock, but try that for very long and you collapse. So the more busy we are, the more we need it. And some of you might be worried about, well, you know, is Pastor suggesting we go back to a 24-hour don't drive, don't walk too far type? Look, I'll leave that to you. The question isn't what's permitted. The question is what gives life. And the busier we are, the more we need intentional time that is devoted to restoring the life that God's given us. Those answers are going to vary for you. One more reason why we might want Jesus to be Lord of the Sabbath. Early on, I was talking about auto dealers and how you can't go to buy a car in the state of Illinois on Sunday. I had friends visiting from Arizona at the last service. They said, you can do it in Arizona. I said, well, what do you expect? It's the Wild West. Yeah. But you can't do it here. And so I have a friend who's an auto dealer, and I asked him about that one time. I said, do you feel like, you know, you're singled out? Because you can pretty much do anything else on Sunday, commerce-wise. Do you feel at a disadvantage? And I thought he'd say, yeah. He said, no, not really. We ought to be able to do it in 6 days. And this is the only way we can give a full day to all of our people to be with their families. I thought that was pretty good. So whose Sabbath is it? Finally, it's yours. It's yours. And anyone's or anything's with whom you share it. It's a gift. Take it. No strings attached. Amen.